The guest hut was long ago prepared, but I went with one of the servants to supervise the unpacking of Lorin's bags. I noticed that someone had cut a spray of the wild cave lilies that grew under the cliffs and placed them in a beer tankard beside the bed. I meant to compliment the Matabili, who acted as our cook, butler, and housekeeper, for this thoughtful little touch. It relieved the bleakness of the hut. After checking Lauren's accommodation, I went down to the big bungalow and made sure there was ice in the refrigerator and plenty of cold water. Then I cracked the seal on a fresh bottle of Glen Grant. Lauren and I have a common fondness for this nectar. While I was busy with the whiskey bottle, Ral and Leslie came in off the dig, and I heard them clump into the office next door. I didn't intend eavesdropping, but the partition walls were paper thin. Ral growled like an enraged beast, and Leslie squealed. "Oh, you are naughty," she cried breathlessly, and it was clear that she'd been physically molested. "Someone will catch you doing that." "As long as they don't catch me doing what I'm going to do tonight," Ral declared. "Shh!" Leslie enjoined silence, but to no avail. 5 weeks. I thought he'd never come. I was going mad. "Oh, Rally Dally, darling," wheezed Leslie in high passion. "Toodles, my little toodles," Ral replied. And I blushed for them. Silently, I set down the bottle and stole from the room. I was slightly puzzled as to how Lauren's arrival, for that was obviously what Ral was referring to, could make such a dramatic improvement in their physical relationship. And I envied them, for I had no such expectation. We were all of us sick to the stomach with a diet of canned and preserved food. Lauren had brought with him a full load of fresh fruit, vegetables, and meat. That night we had a sucking pig, golden brown in its suit of crackling, with roast potatoes, green peas, and a gigantic bowl of fresh salad. There was very little conversation at the dinner table. Once the dishes were cleared, Lauren lit a cigar, I refilled the glasses, and we all settled down in a circle about Lauren. First, I reported to Lauren the discovery of the quarry and the deductions we had made from it. This led on to an exhibition of Sally's reconstruction of the city. I had not expected Lauren to react the way he did. I had thought he might be mildly amused, as we were, not that he would accept our fantasy as proven fact. He worked himself into a fever of excitement, jumping up from his chair to examine each illustration, firing his abrupt, searching questions at us, or simply sitting, hunched forward in his seat, staring at the painting with glitter-eyed concentration. His face was still pale and ravaged, which gave an almost demented intensity to his expression. Sally, with a touch of canny showmanship, had kept the painting of the White King for the last. As she lifted it onto the board, I saw Lauren stiffen in his seat. The White King was in full battle armor, helmet and breastplate in glistening bronze, shield slung, and a short sword girt around his waist. His red-gold beard was curled and clubbed, and his bearing regal. His attendants followed him through the gates of the high outer wall. One carried his battle-axe, another his bow and a quiver of arrows. A third bore the golden chalice of eternal life. Sally had lavished patient skill upon this particular illustration, and it was the most impressive of the whole series. We all stared at it in silence, until suddenly I uncrossed my legs and leaned forward quickly, spilling a little of my whiskey in my surprise. I hadn't noticed it before. The golden beard had masked it. But now I realized suddenly whom Sally had used as her model for the White King. I turned to stare at Lauren, and there was the same deep forehead, the noble brow above white-set, piercing, pale blue eyes. The same straight nose with delicately chiseled nostrils. And the proud curve of mouth, with the slightly sensual pout of the lower lip. Ben. His voice was husky. He didn't take his eyes off the portrait. This is remarkable. I hadn't realized until this evening what this meant. Up to now, it was just intriguing blocks of stone and a few beads and scraps of gold. I never really thought about the people. That's the important thing, Ben. These men that voyaged to the ends of their world, that built something magnificent in the wilderness. He broke off and shook his head slowly, considering the magnitude, the grandeur of it. And then he turned to me. Ben, we've got to find out what happened to them and their city. I don't care how long it takes, how much it costs. I have got to know. Now he stubbed out his cigar and jumped up from his chair and began pacing with a barely controlled violence. It's about time we announced this, Ben. I'll set up a press conference, and I'll want you all there to explain it. The world must know about these men. My stomach dropped steeply with alarm, and I stuttered a protest. But lo, we can't do that. Not now. Not yet. Please. Why not? And he wheeled on me belligerently. We haven't got enough proof yet. I went chill with horror, as I thought how my critics would hang, draw, and quarter me if I went out on the stage with such a sorry script. They'll scalp us, Lo. They'll tear us to pieces. We'll show them these. And he pointed at the paintings. God! I shuddered at the thought. Those that just conjecture, fantasy. In that picture, the only single detail we could substantiate would be the chalice. Lorin stared at me, but I saw the madness fading in his eyes. Suddenly he laughed guiltily and struck his forehead with the heel of his hand. Wow! Well, I must be tired. For a moment there, those paintings were real, from life. He went to stand before the painting again and examined it wistfully. I've got to know, Ben, he said again. I've just got to know. The following day, while we ate lunch beside the Emerald Pool, Lauren told me how he and I were to get away together. He used Sally's charcoal stick to draw on the flat surface of a rock. Here we are, and here, 65 miles to the northeast, are the ruins at Dombashaba. If your theories are correct, then there was an ancient caravan route between the two cities. You and I are going to take the Land Rover and go cross-country, trying to pick up the old trail. It's pretty rough country, I pointed out without enthusiasm. Completely unexplored. No roads, no water. And no BYM, Lauren smiled. That makes it irresistible. I returned his smile, remembering that this was therapeutic, not scientific. When do we leave? Tomorrow morning, at first light. It was still dark when I awoke, and my bedside clock showed 4:30. It was too late to go back to sleep, and too early to get up. I was pondering the problem when the door of the hut opened stealthily, and as I prepared to repel burglars, Ral's hairy head, silhouetted by the moonlight, appeared around the jamb. He had given me a fright, so I shouted at him, "What are you doing?" If I had been frightened, it was as nothing to Ral's reaction to my question. Letting out a howl of terror, he leapt about 3 feet in the air with his arms flapping rather like a crested crane doing its mating dance. It took him a minute or two to recover himself sufficiently to shamble across to his bed and reply in a shaky voice, "I've been to the toilet." Which was just as well, I thought. Otherwise, my challenge could have had disastrous consequences. I got up, dressed, and went out to check the Land Rover. I suppose I guessed that Ral had been with Leslie, but I didn't realize the implications of this. It took Lorin and me most of the first day to find a way over the hills of blood that the Land Rover could negotiate. We followed the line of cliffs northward until they dwindled away and broke up into low kopjes, and we could climb one of the gullies between them. It was a rugged ascent that taxed even that sturdy vehicle, but once on the top, the going was through open savanna and scattered acacia forest, and we made good progress, swinging away southward again to pick up the caravan route that Lauren had hopefully drawn in on his large-scale map. That night we camped astride it, or at least where we hoped it might have been. With the amount of gasoline and water aboard, there was scant room for the luxuries of camp life. Besides, it was meant to be a rough trip, to dispel the smogs and grimes of civilization, a nostalgic return to the expeditions we had made together in our youth. We grilled a brace of sand grouse over the coals, drank Glen Grant, and sun-warmed water from enamel mugs. Then, with hollows scraped from the hard earth for hip and shoulder, we rolled into our sleeping bags beside the Land Rover and chatted drowsily and contentedly for an hour before falling asleep. In the dawn, Lorin massaged his back and gingerly worked the stiffness out of his muscles. "I've just remembered I'm not 20 any longer," he groaned. But by the third day, he was looking it. The sun colored him again, the bruises under his eyes were gone, and he laughed freely. Our progress was slow. Often it was necessary to retrace our spoor out of broken ground where kopjes and ridges denied us passage. Then we would leave the Land Rover and go in on foot to try and pioneer a way through. There was no hurry, however, so we could fully enjoy each mile as we groped our way north and east through country that changed its character and mood with the bewitching rapidity that is Africa's alone. Each hour of eastward travel rewarded us with more evidence of bird and animal life. The dryland birds gave way for guinea fowl, francolin, and the gigantic corrie bustard. Whilst amongst the mapani and masasa trees, there was the occasional silver-grey flash of a running kudu, with his long corkscrew horns laid flat along his back. "Water not far away," Lorin commented as we stopped the Land Rover at the edge of one of those open glades of yellow grass and watched a herd of sable antelope move away into the trees on the far side. The most stately antelope in Africa. Proud heads holding the curved scimitar horns high and the dazzling contrast of snowy breast against black body. "Another endangered species," I remarked sadly, making way for the greed and excesses of man. "Yes," Lorin agreed. "And you know something? There's not one single specimen of Homo sapiens that's half as beautiful. And that," he said, "includes Raquel Welsh." That night we camped in a grove of masasa trees, clad in their outlandish spring foliage, which has the colours of no other tree on earth. Pinks, soft, shiny beige, and flaming reds. Lorin had shot a young impala ram during the day, and he wrapped the fillets in bacon and roasted them in a heavy iron pot, while I made a sauce of onions and tomato and plenty of garlic. We ate it with thick slices of brown bread and yellow tinned butter, and it tasted like no other food I had ever known. "If you ever need a job, Lo, you can come cook for me," I told him around a mouthful. He grinned and went to the Land Rover to switch on the radio. "What was the deal?" I asked. "Just the news." He had the grace to look guilty. "Can't lose touch entirely." We listened to the strivings and the strugglings of a world gone mad. Somehow in this remote and tranquil place, the affairs of man seemed unimportant, petty, and transient. Oh, switch it off, Lo, I said. Who needs it? He reached for the control knob of the set, but checked his hand as the voice of the announcer spoke a familiar name. Lusaka Radio reports that the leader of the terrorist gang which yesterday ambushed a detachment of police in the Wanki district of Rhodesia, killing four and wounding two others, is the self-styled Colonel Timothy Magiba, who 2 months ago made world headlines in his dramatic hijacking bid. A spokesman for the Rhodesian police said that Magiba is probably one of the most dangerous terrorists in Africa. A reward of 10,000 Rhodesian dollars has been offered for information leading to his death or capture. With a savage gesture, Lorin switched off the set and came back to the fire. He sipped his whiskey before speaking. He's operating only 100 miles or so north of here. I'd give anything to get a chance at that one. News of Timothy disturbed me deeply, and that night I lay long awake with my hands behind my head, staring up at the starry splendor of the night sky. Venus had dropped below the horizon before I fell into a sleep troubled with ugly dreams. The morning sun lit the crests of the kopjes a fresh gold and inflamed the sky with virulent reds and purples, driving away dark thoughts, and we talked and laughed together as we picked our way slowly towards the east. In the middle of the morning, we saw the vultures circling off towards the north, a vast wheel of specks turning slowly beneath the hard blue sky. Following the flight of these grotesque scavengers is one of the most intriguing invitations that Africa has to offer, for every time they will lead you to the scene of some desperate incident in the never-ending drama of the wilderness. "Couple of miles off," Lorin commented, peering eagerly ahead through the windscreen. I shared his curiosity. The hell with ruined cities and lost civilizations. This was the stark, raw rule of tooth and claw we were going to witness.